turuntuset tulee jo Onel.
Our today's topic is seeing things differently. And to introduce it, I would like to say that the seeing things differently principle has been one of the most important in the business for, I don't know, the last 20 years or even more. You, Peter, have been one of the most prominent presenters of the idea. And if I remember now my about a bit more than 20 years in marketing, I think that this principle has always been with me. And I always thought that, is it because I knew it myself or is it because I read your books? And I don't know what is the right answer. But to start with, what has been the biggest challenge with teaching the companies to see things differently?
I guess seeing things differently starts with a company who always wants to see the world from their point of view. So the bank thinks that it's the most important company in the world, and the bank thinks that everything it does is the most important thing for the customer. Or the furniture company thinks it's the most important thing in the world, and it thinks its furniture is the most important thing that the customer could ever buy. So I guess the biggest challenge is to stop thinking about your products and your own company and to start thinking about the customers and their world.
How do companies react to your message?
Well, they say, hey, but our company is the most important thing. We've got to talk about our products because we've got to sell our products and customers are interested in our products. So I guess, you know, the reaction is defensive, that they believe that they are the most important thing in the world. They're the center of the universe for the customer. But I guess the center of the universe for most customers, for all of us really, tends not to be the companies we work with. It tends to be our families or it tends to be our lives. It's not the supermarket which we buy our food from. It's the dinner which we sit down to with our family in the evening, for example. It's not the credit card which we get from the bank, but it's the new handbag or the new car which we're able to buy with the money which the bank allows us to use. You know, they're defensive, but they start to realize, well, hey, you know, our livelihood depends on the customer, and maybe we do need to see things from a different perspective. And what I find working with companies all over the world in all different sectors is that when they do start to see things from a customer's point of view, they see things differently. They see bigger opportunities and they see things which are more relevant and more important and more engaging to the customers, and therefore they have a good chance of being more successful.
Can you give us some examples about the companies who have started the process, seeing things from customer point of view and made tremendous breakthroughs or changes?
Sure. So, I mean, I guess there's simple ones like banks. So I worked with a bank in America called Umpqua Bank, and you know, banks are always, as I said, they're always trying to sell you their products, their savings or their loans, or their credit cards, their mortgages. So typical financial products. But then they realize that for the customers, they want something different. So if you're 18 years old and you're just setting out in life, then you want maybe a bit of support. If you're buying your first home, you lack confidence and maybe you need guidance in terms of, well, how do you buy a house? If you're setting up your business, then, you know, that's a whole new world. And it's not just the money or the banking which matters. It's actually lots more details which they could help you with. Or if you're wanting to enjoy life and you're retired and you're, you know, 70 years old, then actually it's about making your money go further. So by developing what they call propositions rather than products, they were able to talk to the customers in language and about things which were much, much more important to them. Another example, seeing things differently, is a hotel chain, a boutique hotel chain, which I worked with in the Indian Ocean, so in Asia. And for many, many years, it saw the conventional wisdom was that Western holiday makers, honeymooners, and retired couples would come to the Indian Ocean to the boutique hotels, and therefore they needed to have infinity pools and luxury dining and wonderful spa massages. But then they realized that by looking at the data and looking at the statistics, a different group of customers were likely to provide their future revenues. And this was the fast rising new middle class of India, particularly. And the new middle class of India tend to be much younger. They tend to be kind of 20 to 30 years old. They tend to travel in families and friends. They tend not to look for scuba diving or for kind of relaxation. They want to have fun. They want to have parties. They want to do gambling because they're not allowed to do gambling in the mainland of India. And they want to do karaoke. So a very different set of product requirements from a different audience. And so this boutique hotel chain, they said, well, as the world changes, as our customers change or different audiences is the new growth area, we need to change our products and services too. And the final one, which might seem a scary one, but comes from the world of funerals. And I approached this project with a little bit of trepidation, particularly when the CEO of the funeral company said to me, we want to find ways to grow the business. So what we did was to look at around the world and say, well, what are the different ways in which people pay for funerals? And actually we found in Holland that around 80% of people pay for their funeral by the time they're 30. Whereas if you look at somewhere else, like the UK, for example, or Germany, then most people don't actually pay for their funerals. They die and then somebody else makes the choices for them and often pays. And so being able to change who pays for the funeral and when they pay for the funeral also changes the mindset. So when people are 30 something or even 20 something, can they pay for their funeral then? They pay it as part of kind of their financial planning. So they might get out life insurance or they might start paying into a pension. And it's just one of those additional things which you pay towards during your adult life, particularly when you buy a house or when you might get married. And so when people do start paying, they start to think more about what kind of funeral do I want? So instead of people being sad and it being black and it being a negative kind of occasion, they want it to be a positive occasion. They want it to be remembered. They want people to have a good time. They want to have their favorite music playing and their favorite photos or videos on the walls. And the average price of a funeral when somebody pays for it after they've died, or the relatives do, is about 2,500 euros. Whereas the average price paid by somebody when they pay for it when they're about 25 to 30 years old, and they buy it like an insurance product, the average price is about 15,000 euros.
Wow.
And so suddenly they pay much more because it means much more to them. It's much more important to them. It's much more personal, and it's much more positive experience. So for the funeral company, by seeing things differently, they're changing their audience, they're changing the motivation of that audience, and therefore they're selling products which are much richer, so they can sell additional products, they can sell premium products, and the profit margin in that is huge compared to what it was before.
Absolutely. Very good example.
Actually, you want to ask again? No, okay. I go on here. For me, I'm listening to you, and it seems to me that actually this differentiation is nothing else than understanding one step further, understanding your customer. Is it statistics or asking them? So it's not something that somebody is sitting at home and thinking, now I have to make something really different. No, you go to your customer and you're trying to find out what the customer is needed. Is it right?
I guess in the past, I agree with you, and I guess in the past, most marketing people have said, we want to be different from the competition. And they get obsessed about the competition. And so they sit there with their products and their competitors sit there with their products and they're obsessed with each other. And they almost don't think about the customer. And so they're both pushing the same products or very similar products at the average customer. Now, the first problem is that there's no such thing as an average person. So if I asked you, are you average, you'd say, no. But, you know, most marketers...
Here in Estonia, we are still average, but okay.
I don't believe you. So certainly the Estonians who I've met are certainly not average. They're very individual and different and charismatic. And, you know, most marketers have got to learn to stop treating their customers as averages. And, you know, having one advertising campaign, one product solution, one price for all their customers. because that assumes that all of their customers are the same. And that's kind of patronizing and condescending. So instead of just being obsessed with having the average solution and therefore being slightly different from your competitor, which usually ends up being slightly cheaper or slightly more expensive, the real challenge for marketers is to be relevant to your customers, to really understand your customer more deeply and to see things from their perspective. And that's what seeing things differently, more than anything else, is all about.
I absolutely do agree with you. Tell me, what is more difficult for a company? Is it more difficult to see the things differently or to act accordingly?
Both are difficult.
Because I know it takes a lot of courage to say that we are not going to target now to all of the customers, but we take a small segment and we are going to satisfy their needs. Every company, every manager is afraid of taking that type of decision, isn't it?
I would be tempted to say that it's harder to make it happen. But the reality is that I think actually it's harder for people to see things differently and to have the confidence in their beliefs to do things differently. So, you know, once the funeral company had decided that they were going to develop a funeral product for the 25-year-old and they were going to sell it through as an insurance product through kind of financial advisors, they can make that happen. It's not hard to make that happen. It's kind of an insurance-based financial product, and you develop the messaging and everything around it. The hard bit is to have the confidence and the bravery to think in that way and to convince your colleagues and your bosses and your shareholders that this is the right new thing to do. So to answer your question, I actually think that seeing things differently is often harder than doing things differently.
And it means the more different the new approach is to our current one, the more difficult it is to sell.
It doesn't mean it's more difficult, because if you found something which customers really want, then it should be very easy. You know, marketing is not actually about selling things to people who don't want things. Marketing is actually about meeting people's needs. And so if we can really find out what their needs or their wants and aspirations are, then it shouldn't be hard to sell. So, you know, saying something is hard to sell is the wrong thing for a great marketer. A great marketer should have found the real need and aspiration in the customer and then being able to match that in a positive way. You know, if you look at Apple's products, you look at Nike's products and, you know, Coca-Cola's, many others, they don't have problems selling their things. You know, their challenge is about looking for the next aspirations, the next emergent wants and needs of the customer.
Yeah, that's true. But if you consider selling the ideas inside the company to our colleagues.
Yeah. So yes, I mean, particularly as you look to colleagues who are not marketers, who have less understanding of customers, particularly in engineering companies and financial service companies and products and any type of product-centered companies, then you'll find people who are more and more immersed in the world of the technology or the technical specifications of those products. And, you know, getting them to understand what the customer really wants, but also to understand why you want to do something in a different way, is often quite hard. And, you know, the way I do that is not to present lots of research statistics to people, which says, you know, sort of 72% of people want this and 67% of people want it like that. And because they kind of just glaze over, I really take not just the marketers, but I take all sorts of people, the technology people, the financial services people, the operational people, out to meet customers, to spend time with real people and to really feel and to see how they can make people's lives better. And, you know, ultimately, everybody is a marketer in a company. They're all about finding ways in which they can understand and then to engage and to meet the changing wants and needs of those customers.
Here in Estonia, we have many log house companies, for example. But anyway, you could take this example or another example. For me, it's interesting to understand what are the easy steps for a company or a product manager or a marketer who actually is facing the problem that all what he or she is seeing is only its his product. And if you ask him, do something differently, he still sees just its own product. And if it's bank, he just sees their products. They can't make themselves to think differently. What are the steps you suggest for those people?
The first step is incredibly simple. It's to spend time with your customer in their lives. So it's not to go out there and just say to a customer, what do you want from our company? So what do you want from your bank, or what do you want from your, I don't know, your furniture company? But it's to actually spend time with them in their lives to understand, how do they use money? What else are they doing? If they're buying furniture, what kind of house are they trying to design or to furnish? So what are the things which really matter to the customers? And spending, you know, at least 2 hours with your customer, not with a tick list of questions, but actually just listening to them, observing them, and understanding what matters to them in their lives suddenly becomes very, very important. And then if a group of people do that from the company, and typically it's not just the product or marketing managers, it could be the other departments too, they come back to the office and they spend some time thinking about this and talking about what they see. And the big, big question they should be asking themselves, whatever industry they're in, is how can we make people's lives better? And that's why we have companies. That's why we have brands. Ultimately, they make money for shareholders or for owners. But the reason they exist is actually to make people's lives better in some way, to add a little bit of something to the universe. And so if they can sit there, having spent sort of 2 hours to a full day with the customer, and together to discuss how can we make people's lives better in some way, then I'm sure they will find hundreds of new ideas and insights which they can start to kind of evolve what used to be product thinking into something which is much more attractive and engaging and relevant to their customers.
What has been the most radical change in business thinking in your practice that you have gone to help somebody and then you have changed, or they together with you have changed something really radically?
I guess the funeral example would be the most radical one, because we turned death into life. So instead of selling to people, so instead of selling funerals to the relatives of dead people, we were selling it to people who were young and full of life. And we were selling it about not commiserating death, but we were about celebrating life.
But what has been most successful, if I ask that way?
Okay, so you know, I think
probably
that's
the same.
The most successful from a financial point of view is probably about 70% improvement in margins was there. To give you another good example of one which really was a transformational project for a client, was Philosophy Skincare. So Philosophy Skincare is a women's cosmetics product made in Phoenix, Arizona, in America. And what they did was to look at, well, who buys our products, and they have a great loyal customer base of people who particularly buy it through direct channels and through QVC on television. And what they did was to recognize that, you know, this group of customers, they weren't the largest in the market, but what they did was that they did not buy cosmetics because it was supposed to be scientifically better to make your skin look, you know, younger or brighter or whatever. They did it because they wanted to have confidence in themselves. So the insight was that it was not about vanity or the image of your face, but it was about the confidence inside. And this network of people were actually quite close to each other on Facebook and other types of social media. They liked connecting with each other. And what we did was to say, well, hey, actually, you know, they would love to be part of a community. So instead of just talking to Philosophy as a brand, Philosophy became the facilitator of facilitating the community of people who bought their products. And these women, they were mainly women who bought the products, started talking to each other. They started sharing their hopes and dreams and their fears about everyday life. And then they started buying the products for each other. And so gifting became a huge market between these customers. So being able to buy products for my friends. So in the same way as you might buy a bunch of flowers for a good friend, if they have a celebration or something, maybe a bad day, then instead you might buy them a cosmetics product. And so making that simple and building a community. So, you know, that had a huge financial impact in terms of the performance of the company and the brand. But also, I think, you know, it was a striking example of the ways in which marketing is changing. You know, marketing used to be about pushing products at people through channels. And so it was like a one-way system of pushing things at people. And the relationship used to be between the brand and the customer. And today, it's much less like that. So we live in a networked world. And that network might be a social network, social media network, or it might be a physical network in terms of a physical community. But people trust other people much more than they trust brands. You know, if you go on vacation somewhere, you look for a hotel on TripAdvisor, you don't trust what the hotel says about itself. And so people trust each other, and people will increasingly buy from each other. And so the relationships which brands need to build are between customers, not between themselves and customers. Loyalty is between customers. I'm loyal to this group of people. And therefore, if the brand can be the facilitator of that, it can be incredibly successful. And if the brand can find ways in which it can sell its products between customers as opposed to at customers, it can be much more profitable too.
Peter, tell me, are there any industries that need the transformation most, or are there industries that don't need it, that have been done already, the transformations that are properly focused to clients and their needs?
I really don't think that there's one industry which you could say is behind the times in every way. So, you know, lots of people say that financial services, because of the financial crisis, they need to fundamentally change. But if you look at financial services, then, you know, there's aspects of financial services which are incredibly innovative, disruptive, and leading the way in making life better. So if you look across Africa, for example, Safaricom developed a financial service product, which is by SMS. And so for people who do not have credit cards or bank accounts in Africa, they can pay for things, or they can give other people money, give their family money by SMS. And so SMS became a currency of money, and they called it M-Pesa. The Spanish word for money. And so M-Pesa has become the most successful financial service brand in all of Africa through quite a simple form of innovation. So that's banking. You know, many of our banks still need to transform themselves in big ways, but we see great innovations. I think one of the biggest innovations, one of the biggest sectors will be healthcare. So healthcare at the moment is still done very conventionally, very traditionally, with pharmaceutical companies spending huge amounts of money developing blockbuster drugs, which are then sold to doctors, and then the doctors supposedly and partially then prescribe them to patients. Pharma 2.0, which all the big pharmaceutical companies are kind of talking about and looking at, is all about a very different way in which the customer or the patient is in control of the healthcare experience and makes much more choices and works with, you know, if they have funding from the government, then they decide how their funding is spent. So I think pharmaceuticals, and particularly with technology kind of converging with pharmaceuticals, and the ability to have life monitoring systems attached to your body, so that, you know, maybe it's like a jawbone bracelet, or maybe it's something more sophisticated, but being able to measure your blood pressure and your metabolic rate and so on in everyday life suddenly changes the way in which we maintain our well-being as well as diagnose health issues. So I think that's one of the areas where we'll see most change in the future.
Actually, I turn back to our log houses and wooden houses we love to produce here in Estonia. It seems still we have discussed it 59 times already.
Probably.
In different shows. But we're still in front of a problem, and this problem is called that we have no ideas what to do to make our log houses more attractive. Do you have any idea? How to think differently?
Yeah, why we ask about the log houses is that we are Europe's, I think, fourth biggest exporters of log houses.
Sometimes the first,
tiny Estonia, and sometimes they even tell that we are the first one. So the companies do something right. There are a lot of them, but still, often we see that they are not. They are probably not.
In most cases, they are selling just the price. To be honest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So. I need your help then.
So, welcome.
So let's think about this. So who is the customer for the log houses?
Usually there are two types of customers. One might be a real estate developer.
Yeah.
And mostly it's either a public body, so it means that they are running tenders.
Okay.
And their usually lowest price is at least one of the components, if not the most important. And then it might be a private body that is developing maybe an area that is a smaller one. Their price still matters, but probably some other things as well.
20 or 30 houses, for
example. 20, yeah, 20, 30 houses, the more small developers. Okay. And there might be also a private customer who tries to buy their own house for the family for the next 50 years.
For example, Japanese, so I don't know why, but they love our houses.
Okay, that sounds good. There's lots of Japanese in the world. So we could think about each of the different customer groups and what are the motivations, but let's just choose one. So should we choose the individual?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So what is the motivation of an individual, do you think, for buying a log house?
Probably you can have different groups of people there. Among the individuals, yeah.
And, give me some
yeah, and I think that at least one of them is the family who thinks that the log house is healthy.
Yeah.
There is some kind of theory that it breathes well. Yeah, somehow it's good air in the log house.
Okay.
Kind of good vibes. It looks natural, and we really love the natural design, and probably the clients as well. And I know in Japan there is one more thing, that the log house is earthquake resistant, or not resistant, but somehow kind of according to the
it's not so static somehow. Yeah.
Okay, I understand. So you have an interesting idea there about being healthy.
Yes.
So it's like, it's not the fact they're made of wood, it's like they're healthy houses.
Okay.
Or they're, you know, it's a bit like organic food, they're organic houses.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like going on a kind of, you know, a health spa. It's like going on a vacation to, you know, in alpine forests or somewhere like that. It's about buying sustainable clothing or sustainable, you know, electric cars. It's about, and suddenly, I guess, when you start to think in this way about what the customer is buying, they're not buying a log house. They're buying healthy family life, or they're buying my personal health, or they're buying my well-being or my perception of well-being. Now, how much more do you think people pay for organic vegetables than for normal vegetables?
I think the general price difference is in about 30%.
Yes, up to 30, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not very sure about that.
Okay, but so 20 to 30% would be quite normal. And then you have people who, you know, not only make positive choices about their health and will be prepared to pay every day 30% more for their food, but you have people who might buy, you know, healthy supplements, or they might buy special types of tablets, or they might go on special types of spa vacations, which cost maybe three times as much as the cheapest vacation they could go on.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
you know, they might buy a type of vacuum cleaner which has a pollen filter in and costs twice as much as the normal kind of vacuum cleaner, and so on. You know, I guess the point is that as soon as you start to think about the motivation of the customer, and you gave me just an example of health there, then people, it becomes emotional. And it's not about the functional wood and so on, and it becomes emotional. It's about my family, it's about my life, it's about my well-being. And people emotionally will pay much more for things which are very important to them. So suddenly you increase the priority to them, and you increase the, as marketers, the price elasticity, how much somebody would pay extra for it. And therefore you kind of have to start marketing it in a different way. So the conversation with the customer no longer is about, you know, do you want a wooden house from Estonia, but do you want to live a healthier life? Or for your children, do you want to have a healthier life, and all the other things which might go with it? So you start to change the conversation, and it's a very different way of thinking about it. And then once you have the way of thinking, you might be able to target customers better. So you look for customers who buy organic food, and maybe they're a good target customer to sell these houses to, or customers who go on a certain type of vacation, or customers who buy a certain kind of low carbon emission car. And they would be great target audiences for these log houses. So by thinking this different way and getting some ideas very quickly, just by having a conversation with the customer, it creates a hypothesis by which you can then start to think differently about who is your target audience and what is your value proposition and what is the motivation by which they buy it and what is the motivation by which they would pay more for it.
I think it's a great example, but I know that probably most of the Estonian owners or top managers of the log house companies will tell that, oh, you know, the market is not so big that we could allow us to segment it. We should sell houses to everyone.
Oh, well, they're fools. So
Thank you. We will tell them.
The reality is that nobody needs 100% of the market. And the reality is also in today's world that the biggest companies are not always the best ones. So if you look at the companies with the highest market share in any sector, so, you know, GM, General Motors, still makes more cars than any other company in the world, but it's certainly not the most profitable. So just by having lots of customers or just by selling lots of products does not make you the most successful company. If you look in the car industry in Europe, the most profitable car company is Porsche. And if you look at how many units of cars it sells, how many vehicles it sells compared to GM or Volkswagen, then it's minuscule. But the profit margin is much bigger. And obviously what it's doing is it's targeting a niche audience. And so we've got to get away from this idea that, you know, more volume, more sales, more market share is the measure of success. It's not always the case. That was only when we used to sell commodities and all products were equal. But when you have differentiated products and when you can charge a premium for them, then it's about targeting and it's about finding these smaller audiences which are much more valuable to you, which is the smart way of running business.
Very good. Just my final question is, you have been working with so many different industries, so many different companies all over the world.
Yeah.
What are your sources to find the new ideas? Let's say so that you have the information from the customer, and might be that the company is doing everything what the customer wants. Do you look at the other sources, or how do you combine the information to come to the, let's say, the one idea that makes the difference?
Well, let me say first of all, I don't think ever that the customer has run out of everything which they need. So there's always something more which you could do for the customer. You know, nobody needed an iPad before Steve Jobs created one. So there's still an opportunity. I think in general, you know, what is the best source of ideas beyond talking to the customer is to look to other markets. So I call these parallel markets. So, for example, if you're in telecoms, you know, Estonia Mobile Telecom might want to look at retailing, and you can learn ideas from retailing. You could learn ideas from automotive. You could learn ideas from the entertainment industry particularly. You could learn ideas from the travel industry. And, you know, I think you can learn very little from your competition because you're kind of very similar to them. So it's not what you learn from people in your sector, but you can learn a lot from people in other sectors, from competitors or companies in other sectors who are often not competitive. So you can actually go and talk to them. And so, you know, you can find suddenly a telecoms person going and talking to their peer in the bank or in the supermarket or in the travel, in the airline. So, you know, suddenly you find lots and lots of ideas by which AirBaltic, for example, in Latvia, has been very successful in terms of doing with its customers. So why can't you apply that to telecommunications or something which a supermarket has been able to do? And therefore, how can you not apply that to telecommunications? Because it's the same customers who use these things. And if you find some kind of service or some kind of way of communicating things and supporting the customer, which works, which the customer likes, which they're prepared to pay for, it's a great experimental lab, which then you can then take those ideas and you can bring them to your own industry. And so, you know, I think parallel markets and taking things across borders is incredibly powerful. And it's actually what Leonardo da Vinci did hundreds and hundreds of years ago. You know, he started as a sculptor, and then he became an artist. From his sculpting, he was able to draw better art because he understood how the body moved. But then he became a mechanic because he understood how the muscles worked from his sculpting. And so, you know, by crossing industries or crossing genres, as Leonardo da Vinci did, he was able to make breakthroughs. He was able to do things which nobody had ever thought of before.
I think it's a very good example. It just reminds me, it was several years ago when I was working in the fashion industry, and we had a meeting with a bank talking about product development. And it was very interesting when the bank guys told us that it takes them about 1.5 years to create a new product. And then we from the fashion industry looked at them and told that you're welcome to learn from us. It takes us 2 weeks to create a new product.
Okay.
The product is not similar, but the ways of developing and the ways of doing it might be enriching for both sides.
Absolutely.